My dear brethren and sisters, in the reading which we just read together in the 2nd of Kings, we find ourselves there with Elisha. And in 2nd of Kings and chapter 2, almost the first thing which Elisha does in verse 19 of 2nd of Kings chapter 2. The men of the city, that is Jericho from the previous verse, perhaps the men were the sons of the prophets, we can't be absolutely sure, it doesn't matter altogether, but the men of the city came to Elisha and said, "Behold, I pray thee, the situation of the city is pleasant, but as my Lord seeth, the water is naught, and the ground is barren." Naught meaning bad or good for nothing. And we can see barren is causing to miscarry. And so the water then was causing a problem. The ground was barren. And he said unto them, "Bring me a new cruse and put salt therein." And they brought it to him. And he went forth to the spring of the waters and cast the salt in there. And said, "Thus saith Yahweh, I have healed these waters. There shall not be from thence any more death or barren land." And at a glance, we might suppose it was the salt that healed the waters. That's not true, of course. It was Yahweh that healed the waters. And so having come to the conclusion, having read it properly, that it was Yahweh that healed the waters, what was the purpose of the salt? No doubt we're aware, if you put salt into a spring, then the salt is carried away from the spring. It won't do anything for the spring itself. But we are told why. It's at the end of verse 21. "There shall not be from thence any more death or barren land." And the salt was the symbol. The salt was the symbol of the permanent nature of the healing of the waters. Now when we look at salt elsewhere, we find that salt really speaks of two very different ideas. If we come back with me please to Genesis 19. We see here the first time that salt is mentioned in this way. It's the time when Lot and his family were taken out of Sodom and Gomorrah. And in verse 26 of Genesis 19, we read, "But his wife looked back from behind him, and she became a pillar of salt." Now the instruction in verse 17 was, "It came to pass when they had brought them forth abroad, that he said, Escape for thy life, look not behind thee, neither stay thou in all the plain, escape thou to the mountain, lest thou be consumed." And now, Lot's wife. Perhaps literally, as well as in her mind, lingers. She not only looked back, but she looked back from behind him. So she then was dragging her feet. She was less willing to be taken away from that city. And eventually she couldn't resist that last look. So perhaps telling us then that instead of being with her husband, literally a gap had opened up and he was going forward, but her mind was still behind. And she therefore, in her mind, was really still in Sodom and Gomorrah. That was where her heart was. She longed for it. What of us, brethren and sisters? We too have been caused to escape from the things of the world. We've been caused to escape from the ways of the flesh which we see so much in evidence round about us. We have been called away from those things. Even from that way of thinking of the flesh, the way of thinking of the world, away from it. And yet, sometimes, do we go back there? If not literally, then in our mind's eye, in the way we think, the way we react, does the world still have its influence upon us? Or are we wholehearted in our escape from such things, knowing full well that destruction is coming upon it? We can only think of these exhortations for ourselves and apply them each to ourselves honestly as we examine ourselves. But that then is the first time this salt is used in this way. It's used, of course, as judgment. Judgment against longing for the things of the flesh. And it's not the only time that it's used in that way. If we just have a look at Deuteronomy 29, for example. Deuteronomy 29. Verse 22. Well, go back to verse 21. Yahweh shall separate him unto evil out of all the tribes of Israel, according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in this book of the law, so that the generation to come of your children that shall rise up after you, and the stranger that shall come in from a far land shall say, when they see the plagues of that land and the sickness which Yahweh hath laid upon it, and that whole land thereof is with brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adamar and Zeboim, which Yahweh overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. And so these people are caused to question, why has this happened? And the answer, of course, is that it's judgment. Verse 26. For they went and served other gods and worship them, and gods whom they knew not, whom he had not given unto them. And the anger of Yahweh was kindled against this land, to bring upon it all the curses that are written in this book. And so the land being sown with salt, burned with brimstone, was a symbol of the anger of Yahweh against his people, this time for idolatry. And we needn't turn to it now, but we could go to Judges chapter 9 and see a similar thing where the land is sown with salt by way of judgment upon the people. And so, perhaps surprisingly, first off, when we come to the salt in Scripture, it's not speaking of covenant at all, but it's speaking of judgment. Judgment against the thinking of and the longing for the things of the flesh, and judgment against idolatry. But perhaps we're more used to the idea of salt being associated with covenant. If we go to 2 Chronicles and chapter 13, we see there what is perhaps the familiar passage where we might expect to go. 2 Chronicles and chapter 13. And verse 4. And Abijah stood up upon Mount Zemaraim, which is in Mount Ephraim, and said, Hear me, thou Jeroboam and all Israel. Ought ye not to know that Yahweh, God of Israel, gave the kingdom over Israel to David forever, even to him and to his sons, by a covenant of salt? So Jeroboam should have known that the king, the kingdom, the throne, was given to David and to his sons. Not just to David, but to his sons forever. A covenant of salt. a covenant, we might say, which was preserved, so that no one else could be king over God's people. Only David and his descendants. It was not a transferable covenant. It wasn't a covenant which would be allowed to fall into ruin. It was preserved for David and his seed. So it was a covenant of salt, a covenant which should last for him forever. And of course, we are aware that the throne which our Master will come and sit upon will be the throne of David, given to him, to David and his sons, as a covenant of salt. Likewise, in Numbers and chapter 18, if we just come back with me there to Numbers 18, there we see the way in which certain of the offerings were given to the priests. Numbers chapter 18. And verse 19. This is all to do with the offerings which were given to Aaron and his sons. And so verse 19 says, "And all the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offer unto Yahweh have I given to thee," that is Aaron, "and thy sons and thy daughters with thee, by a statute forever." It is a covenant of salt, forever, before Yahweh, unto thee and to thy seed with thee. So it was a covenant which should not have been broken, should not have decayed. It was given to Aaron and his seed by statute forever. It was preserved. And so then, scripturally, we have these two ideas now presented to us. One of judgment and one of the association of salt being a preservative, but in the specific context of covenants made by Yahweh. Now, if we go back to Leviticus chapter 2, we find there instruction in its context to do with the meat offering. Although it seems to be quoted elsewhere, to do with all other offerings as well. But Leviticus 2 and verse 13 says, "Every oblation of thy meat offering shalt thou season with salt. Neither shalt thou suffer the salt of the covenant of thy God to be lacking from thy meat offering. With all thine offerings thou shalt offer salt." So the salt then wasn't the main ingredient. Certainly, as far as the meat offering was concerned, the main ingredient was the fine flour, the frankincense, and so on that went with it. And there wasn't a great quantity of salt either, for it was seasoned with salt. And the word "season" there is literally to rub something so that it becomes so small it almost disappears. So there was that very small sprinkling of salt put in with the rest of the ingredients. No doubt when he had been added to the ingredients, he would hardly be seen at all. And yet it is deemed to be important. "With all thine offerings thou shalt suffer salt." It wasn't to be missing. "Thou shalt not suffer the salt of the covenant of thy God to be lacking." And so we're told there in that verse what the association of the salt is. It was to do with the covenant. And so the people were reminded then that the covenant which bound Yahweh to his people, and the whole reason for all of their offerings which they made, was everlasting. It wasn't something which could be broken. But the people had to do their part. They had to add the salt. And I would suggest, brethren and sisters, that we too, we are on the receiving end, if we can use the expression, of those same covenants if we remain faithful. And they are everlasting. No one can take those covenants from us. If only. If only we remain faithful. And I would suggest that That is the ingredient which we have to offer. Of itself, really, quite small, but so vitally important that all that we do is offered with the salt of the covenant. Having the faith to believe in the covenants of promise. They are fundamental to our beliefs, are they not, brethren and sisters? Those covenants which were given to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob. How vital it is that we believe them. They are the bedrock of much of our beliefs. And they are permanent. Nothing will take them away, provided we remain faithful. And it is faith that prevents corruption. If we go over to Psalm 16. Here, of course, David was writing prophetically. He was writing in particular messianically. And so we have the thoughts in prophecy, the thoughts of the Master. And verse 1 of Psalm 16 says, "Preserve me, O God, for in thee do I put my trust." The whole life of the offering of our Master that we have come to remember through the bread and the wine, his whole life was an offering which was offered with the salt. He never forgot the covenant. He always added his own ingredient of faith in the covenant and in his Father. He understood, above all, that his preservation was in the hands of the Father. "Preserve me, O God, in thee do I put my trust." And as a result of his faith, as a result of the fact that, of course, he lived his faith, then we go on into verse 10, "For thou wilt not leave my soul in hell." He wasn't allowed to corrupt. "Thou wilt not suffer thine holy one to see corruption, but thou wilt show me the path of life. In thy presence is fullness of joy. At thy right hand are pleasures forevermore." Because of his faith in the things of the covenants. Well, all of these things, brethren and sisters, are brought together for us in the New Testament. If we move over to Mark and chapter 5, we see there that when the Master was using these words, it becomes full of meaning, having now looked at the Old Testament way in which it occurs. Did I say Mark? I've gone to Mark. Sorry, I meant Matthew. Matthew and chapter 5. That's better. Matthew chapter 5. And verse 13 records Jesus saying, "Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt have lost his savour, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing but to be cast out, to be trodden under foot of men. Ye are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hid, neither do men light a candle, but put it under a bushel, but on a candlestick, and it giveth light unto all that are in the house. So let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works, and glorify your Father which is in heaven." So we told them what the light is. The light isn't the standing on street corners and shouting at passers-by. We're told in verse 16 that it's the way we live our lives. "So let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works," so that there is a consequence, "that they may glorify the Father which is in heaven," so they may come to an understanding of the truth. Now, the parallel idea is that we are the salt of the earth. We are the preservative of the earth. in the sense that we have the truth. No one else on the surface of the earth, brethren and sisters, unless they understand the same things that we do, can preach the truth. We therefore have that element of preservation. Those who would understand those same things that we do are preserved. Equally so, we are the salt, we are the preservation of the earth. If it weren't for the saints upon the earth, then surely the judgments that are coming upon the earth would have come. It is not until the saints are taken away that judgment is poured out upon the earth, and so many will lose their lives. So we then, in our dealings with those round about us, it is purely ourselves, our own way of life, our demonstration of those things which we believe, which can help to preserve others, if only they have eyes to see and ears to hear this marvellous preserving truth which we have. So in our dealings then, one with another, or rather in our dealings with those round about us, we should be prepared and ready to answer. For we're told in Colossians, if we would go now to Colossians and chapter 4. Colossians chapter 4 and verse 6, let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man. So we ought then to have prepared ourselves. We ought to have within us, within our hearts and our minds, the knowledge and the willingness to discuss the things of the truth, so that we can answer whoever might ask us. And of course, our first obligation in that context, for many of us, is in our own homes. Surely it is in our own homes that many of the questions which arise, which do arise there, can be answered. Many of us have that responsibility to be willing to discuss, to encourage our families in the things of the truth, always ready to answer with a proper scriptural answer those things which we believe to those of our own household. But of course, it is not limited to those, but to any other man, to every man here who might ask us those questions. But if we go to Galatians, First of Peter and chapter 2. First of Peter and chapter 2, we saw in Matthew that it was to do with the way we live our lives. So in verse 11 of 1 of Peter and chapter 2, the apostle exhorts, dearly beloved, I beseech you, notice the urgency here, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Now the only way those Gentiles can glorify God in the day of visitation is if they come to an understanding of the truth. Well, what of our way of life then, brethren and sisters? What of our conversation? That is, of course, the way of life when we are among the Gentiles. It's fairly simple and straightforward, isn't it, to have our conversation honest, that is, to the things of the truth, when we're with one another on a Sunday afternoon or whenever it may be. There's no pressure on us then, is there, to conform to the ways of the world. But when we are with our colleagues at work, or any of those with whom we have to do who constitute the Gentiles, then perhaps we may be under more pressure to conform to the ways of the world. And then that we need to have our way of life honest to the truth when we are among the Gentiles, so that they might recognise that we are the salt of the earth and the means of their preservation. So we see then that the salt has a context of our dealings with others. But it also has its context of our dealings one with another. And now we move on to the Gospel of Mark, and it's Mark and chapter 9. Mark and chapter 9, and the last two verses mention the salt. And we read that every, verse 49, that everyone shall be salted with fire. Now we might expect to say salted with salt. But having of course looked at the Old Testament background, we understand that the salt is not only preservative, but it also speaks of judgment. And so then everyone shall be judged, if we may simply paraphrase it. Every sacrifice salted with salt. So what then of our way of life? Well, both elements of the symbology of the salt are of relevance to us. It's vitally important, isn't it, that we look forward to the kingdom, that we believe in the promises made to the fathers, that we understand and believe that they were confirmed in the sacrifice which we have come to remember, that we look forward to their fulfilment. But we must never forget that there is the judgment. We must never forget, brethren and sisters, that there will be wailing and gnashing of teeth, and that those who wail and those whose teeth gnash are those who are at the judgment, but hear those dreadful words, "Depart from me, I never knew you." And those who are at the judgment are responsible. And so the wailing could be you, or it could be me. So we shall be salted with fire, brethren and sisters, and whether we survive that salting or whether or not remains to be seen. But indeed, much of our lives concerns trial. If we go to 1 Peter and chapter 1, salting with salt isn't something which is yet future. It was something certainly in the first century which was extremely relevant. 1 Peter chapter 1. And verse 6, "Wherein ye greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, ye are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith," there is the salting with fire, "be much more precious than with gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found with praise and honour and glory at the appearing of Christ." Now we, brethren and sisters, do not find ourselves dipped in tar and put on a post for the amusement of the Roman emperors. Our brethren were of this generation. But nevertheless, we too, in our own way, have our trials and our tribulations. And whether we survive, whether our faith remains intact, is really up to us. Or whether we are lost to the trials and temptations, it's for us to resolve ourselves, to confirm ourselves and our belief in this precious word which we have, or whether we are cast underfoot and trodden underfoot, as we saw in Mark. And it's in Luke that we are reminded of that. If we go to Luke in chapter 14. Luke 14 and verse 34. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its savour, wherewith shall it be seasoned? Now how do you tell whether salt has lost its savour? It's by taste. And I would suggest that we are being reminded here of something else which the Master said, that it's not that which enters into a man that defiles him, but rather that which comes out of a man. Because that which comes out of a man, his words, give away the status of his heart. And so if those words which we speak are good, all well and done, but if the salt has lost its savour, if our speech isn't seasoned with salt, it's because our heart has become corrupt. And if that is the case, then verse 35 says, neither fit for the land, nor yet for the dunghill, but men cast it out. And that's the warning of the salt, brethren and sisters, that the judgment is coming, and we should be cast out. Unless we add to our sacrifice of our way of life, all that we do, our faith in the things of the covenant. For if we go back then to 2 Kings, the salt then was the symbol of the preservative. And we have this immense privilege that our faith and our obedience, particularly around these emblems, but at all times in our way of life and the way we live our life in accordance with our faith, holds out this hope for us, not simply of preservation, but of life, and that abundantly. But before we came to the things of the truth, we were just as this land was. We read at the end of verse 21 that it brought forth death and it was barren. That was our state before we put our faith in the things of the truth in general and in death and resurrection of our Master in particular. So we come now then, brethren and sisters, to partake of the bread and of the wine, to add to those things which we have been given our own ingredient of salt, our remembrance of the things of the covenant, always remembering that, yes, there will be a judgment, but that nothing can take away the preservation of the covenant of salt if only we remain faithful.